And as you say, this is not fringe science at this point. This is well documented. In fact, of course, even the International Agency for Research on Cancer famously declared over a decade ago that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen to humans. But as you say, it's even worse than that, because, of course, we are not exposed to glyphosate by itself. We are exposed to it in these commercial formulations, which are even more toxic, a toxicity which is not taken into account by these regulators. The obvious question then, why then have the regulators not taken this issue seriously? Why is Roundup still the most used herbicide in the history of humanity?
I think this gets to the core of the matter for sure, James.
You're listening to the Corbett Report.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com here in July of 2026. And if you are watching this podcast in July of 2026, and if you have been following the news recently, you will notice glyphosate is back in the news. Specifically, you'll have noticed the story that came out recently regarding the seemingly never-ending legal saga around Monsanto / Bayer's Roundup weed killer and the lawsuits that are ongoing about the cancers that have been caused by that agent. And you will have noticed some of the recent developments in that story. For example, you'll know last December that the Trump administration actually filed a brief with the Supreme Court in support of Monsanto / Bayer, trying to shield them from such lawsuits. And you will also know that late last month, the U.S. Supreme Court has indeed barred states from protecting consumers if federal agencies won't. And there are some legal nuance with regards to what this is about, etc. But the long story short is that the many people who have been in the process of suing Monsanto and their parent company Bayer over this Roundup weed killer cancer story are, well, their cases are in legal jeopardy. But it's not just in the U.S. where this is something that's in the news right now. For example, in Europe, you might have heard of the Food and Feed Safety Simplification Omnibus. And if you haven't, of course, I'll throw in the link to that in the show notes for today's conversation. I will also direct you to a GMWatch.org article about families suffering from pesticide exposure demand better health protection, not deregulation, talking about some of the some of the bad things that are in this food safety simplification omnibus. But you do not want to hear me expounding on these subjects. You would like to hear someone who really knows what they are talking about at the base scientific level as well as at the regulatory level. So today we're going to be talking to Dr. Michael Antoniou, who is a professor emeritus in molecular genetics at King's College London, and is an expert in these issues. He has written studies on mammalian toxicity of herbicides used in intensive GM crop farming. He has written about comparative toxigenomics of glyphosate and Roundup herbicides by mammalian stem cell-based genotoxicity assays and molecular profiling in Sprague-Dawley rats and other such very fascinating studies. I will, of course, link up his about page at King's College London, but let's bring him on the program. Dr. Michael Antoniou, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to join you today, James, to discuss what is a very, very important subject.
It is a very important subject. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people may vaguely know about this subject, but they don't know about it in great depth. So, let's start today. Let's just get people on board with some basic facts about what we're talking about. First of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to study this subject, and then we're going to get into what glyphosate is and why people should be concerned about it.
Yes. So as you introduced me, I have Professor Emeritus status in molecular genetics and toxicology with King's College London. And I'm emeritus because as of October last year, I retired. So I don't have an active research group anymore, but remain intimately connected with academia, including on glyphosate toxicology issues. But prior to that, in the last 13 or so years of my active time at King's College London, I introduced or developed a toxicology program, molecular cellular toxicology program, with a focus on pesticides and with a, a special interest in glyphosate-based herbicides. So my group, I feel proud to say, became a world leader in glyphosate herbicide toxicology. And the work in my group identified novel mechanisms by which glyphosate herbicides can bring about toxicity. So that generally is my background. So as to what is glyphosate, glyphosate was actually created. It's not a naturally occurring molecule. It was invented back in the 1950s by a German chemist. And it's a derivative of an amino acid that I'm sure all listeners will have heard of called glycine. So that's why its chemical name is called N-phosphonomethylglycine, glyphosate for short. And for many years, it remained really just a curiosity and didn't have much use, except it was discovered early on that it was a very potent binder or chelator, as we call it technically, of metals, including nutrient metals, by the way, such as magnesium, manganese, calcium, and so forth. And that, we may want to return to this as part of our conversation going forward, because it's an often forgotten aspect by which glyphosate can bring about toxic effects. Because if glyphosate in the soil or in the plant that it's been sprayed with binds these nutrient metals, not only does it prevent them to be utilized by the plant, but also by you and I, when we ingest them. But that is a bit of a side issue. The key thing about in the history of glyphosate is that in the early 70s, Monsanto Company in the United States discovered that it had very potent weed-killing herbicide properties. And in 1973 or 74, it launched a product called Roundup, which is based on glyphosate as the weed-killing agent. The thing about glyphosate is that it kills all plants. So, the way it does that is it inhibits a biochemical pathway in plants. It's known as the shikimate pathway for aficionados listening in. But this biochemical pathway, the shikimate pathway, is responsible, among other things, for manufacturing, synthesizing certain crucial amino acids, aromatic amino acids, that the plant needs to build its proteins. So when glyphosate comes in and inhibits this biochemical pathway, these essential amino acids are not manufactured and the plant dies because it can't make its proteins, it can't grow. And but this biochemical pathway, the shikimate pathway, is present in all plants. So glyphosate is what's known as a broad spectrum herbicide. It kills everything. And so therefore, you couldn't spray your crop to kill weeds and keep your crop alive, because it would kill your crop as well. So for many years, glyphosate was used for weed clearance before you planted your crop and those kinds of measures. So its use didn't really expand very much because of its broad spectrum nature. But in 1976 is a very crucial year in the history of this substance. In 1976, Monsanto Company launched its first genetically modified crops engineered to be tolerant to glyphosate. So now the farmer could grow his or her soybeans or corn, maize, spray the crop would survive, but the weeds will die. And that, since the mid-90s, since 1996, with the rapid adoption of these genetically modified crops, there are now many crops that have been launched that are tolerant to glyphosate, not only corn, maize, soy, but also sugar beet, alfalfa, to name a few more. And what we saw then was an absolutely massive escalation in the use of glyphosate herbicides. Admittedly, the cultivation of these glyphosate-tolerant crops has remained concentrated in relatively few countries, North America and South America, and one or two other places as well. But this resulted, of course, was that with a massive increase in glyphosate herbicide use with these crops, we have the environmental impact escalated enormously, because it would kill weeds. What are weeds to the farmer, but what are natural habitats for other wildlife? But also, of course, the residues of glyphosate herbicides in foodstuffs and exposure to occupational exposure, the workers on the farms, as well as those in urban areas, say groundsmen at schools or playgrounds and golf courses and places like this, also massively increased too. So we've had this massive increase in glyphosate herbicide exposure since the mid-1990s. And it's now, at the moment, it's estimated that something in excess of 700,000 kilograms of glyphosate herbicides are sprayed annually around the world as we speak, because it has become the most massively used herbicide in history, but actually the most massively used pesticide of any sort in history to this day.
And that is just in a few decades of use. It's quite startling to think about.
It is.
And so obviously, yes, obviously it has been formulated specifically for its ability to act as a broad general purpose herbicide that will kill everything except what has been genetically modified to withstand it at least in terms of crops and weeds and plants. But I would assume that at least the story that the industry would use is that there is no documented ill health effects on mammals from these residues. I would assume that your research proves otherwise, but enlighten us on that fact.
Yes, indeed. Going back to the mechanism of action of glyphosate herbicides, the inhibition of the shikimate pathway, one of the arguments of industry, especially Monsanto Company, was that, well, the shikimate pathway isn't present in animals and humans. Therefore, it can't harm us as a result. And so they always argued that it was just totally safe. Now, there are many flaws in this argument, which I'll just go through with you now, James. First of all, glyphosate can exert toxicity through other mechanisms other than inhibition of the shikimate pathway. It can, even since the late 1970s, it was known to cause in various studies, and the work has just become absolutely solid, that glyphosate causes oxidative stress. I will elaborate on that shortly. But oxidative stress is not a good thing. It's a highly damaging entity in our bodies if it exists, and can cause numerous types of damage which could lead to serious illnesses, including cancer. So that's one and that Monsanto clearly ignored when they made this statement. Oh, it's completely safe because the shikimate pathway is not present in us. It has ignored other mechanisms of toxicity. The other crucial point that, again, my group was the first to demonstrate definitively was that the shikimate pathway may not be present in animals and humans, but it is present in certain types of bacteria and fungi. And this includes bacteria in our gut microbiome. Now, again, I'm sure all listeners to this podcast will know just how crucial the function, the balanced function of our gut microbiome is for our health. I mean, again, you've only got to open the newspapers any week, and there's another story of just how important maintaining good gut microbiome function is to our health. Because the bacteria and fungal population in our gut is not only there helping us to digest our food, but it produces crucial signaling molecules that feed into the body to maintain balanced immune system function, cardiovascular function, and even nervous system function, because an imbalanced gut microbiome can even lead to behavioral problems, extraordinarily enough, and as well as physical problems, not only in the gut, like inflammatory bowel disease, but problems in other organ sites, such as in the liver. It can result in inflammation in the liver and contribute to cancer formation as well. So anything that impedes the balanced functioning of the gut microbiome is not a good thing. And there's now very solid evidence from my group and elsewhere that shows that indeed glyphosate does cause gut microbiome imbalance, or dysbiosis, as we call it. And that also includes the onset or the occurrence of leaky gut. So the gut microbiome dysbiosis ultimately leads to the gut structure becoming compromised. Now, this is very important because between the gut cells, the gut epithelial cells that line our gut, they're very tightly joined up to prevent undigested foods and toxins and other things getting into the body. But when you have compromised gut integrity, what is known as colloquially, but even medically now known as leaky gut, then you end up with partially digested food and even components of our gut bacteria entering the bloodstream. They hit different sites, especially the liver, and can cause inflammation and disease problems there as well. And my group recently has published a paper that shows that glyphosate can indeed result in leaky gut in a rat animal model system. So that's another area, again, which has been ignored by industry in its claims of glyphosate safety, and which is unfortunately being ignored by regulatory agencies. So the third and crucial thing I'd like everybody to be aware of as we go forward to discuss the glyphosate herbicide toxicity is this, and this is very, very important again. When either a farmer or someone who's going to be using glyphosate herbicides in an urban environment, doesn't matter, you in your garden, if you buy Roundup and spray it in your garden, what you're spraying is not just a solution of glyphosate. It's not like a water solution of glyphosate. In fact, if you made a water solution of glyphosate, which is easy to do, and you spray it on your plants, nothing happens. Why is that? It's because the glyphosate can't get into the plant to exert its plant-killing properties. What the manufacturer has had to do right from the beginning, from the very first launch of Roundup herbicide in 1974, in the industry, Monsanto and other manufacturers have had to work in what are known as co-formulants or adjuvants into the mix. These adjuvants, co-formulants, perform numerous functions. But one of the crucial things they do is they not only allow the herbicide to wet the plant well, but also they basically punch holes in the plant cell walls. And as a result, the glyphosate can get in and kill the plant. Now, it turns out, and here again, we have an overwhelming body of evidence. My group has repeatedly shown that this is the case through comparative studies where we compare the toxicity of glyphosate alone compared to commercial formulations of glyphosate herbicides. Invariably, the commercial formulations are far more toxic than glyphosate alone in all of the measures. This is going back to early work of my former colleague, Robin Minage, when he was working with Gilles-Éric Serralini in France. He was the first to do these comparative studies and showed that some glyphosate herbicide formulations, commercial formulations, can be up to 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate alone. And that work is more crucially, we've shown that that is indeed the case with in animal model systems, regulatory recognized laboratory animal model systems, such as the rat. And we've, in all of the tests we've done in terms of effects on the gut microbiome, liver toxicity, kidney toxicity, gut structural integrity, the formulations, commercial formulations, have always been far more toxic than the glyphosate alone. Glyphosate alone is toxic as well, but there's a huge amplification of that toxicity with the coformulants. Why is this an important point? It's because basically regulators do not require long-term toxicity studies of commercial formulations when they assess the toxicity of, say, glyphosate here. They pass regulations based on tests on glyphosate alone. And that is a massive act of negligence on behalf of the regulators anywhere in the world. Because, as I say, the evidence is overwhelming that the coformulants are highly toxic in their own right. And, of course, it's the whole formulation that people are exposed to. It's not just glyphosate alone. When an applicator goes around spraying and they're breathing it, they're getting contact on their skin. It's the whole formulation. It's the whole formulation that's getting into the food that we eat. And therefore, to just pass so-called safety evaluation based on the glyphosate alone is simply not, the regulator isn't doing their job properly and putting public health at risk.
Well, I think you hit on one of the key issues here, which is the issue of public safety and the regulators. Surely they care about the public, right? And as you say, this is not fringe science at this point. This is well documented. In fact, of course, even the International Agency for Research on Cancer famously declared over a decade ago that glyphosate is a probable carcinogen to humans. But as you say, it's even worse than that, because, of course, we are not exposed to glyphosate by itself. We are exposed to it in these commercial formulations, which are even more toxic, a toxicity which is not taken into account by these regulators. The obvious question then, and perhaps I'm going to be willfully naive in asking this question, because I think there might be some, unfortunately, not willfully naive people in the audience who do not understand this. Why, then, have the regulators not taken this issue seriously? Why is Roundup still the most used herbicide in the history of humanity?
I think this gets to the core of the matter for sure, James. I could only, first of all, that I think there is a good account of just how influential industry is on regulatory government regulatory agencies in setting the criteria by which their own products are evaluated. It's well documented, and even the criteria regulatory agencies rely on laboratory animal toxicity studies to set their so-called safe exposure limits. And the criteria by which a given animal toxicity study is eligible to be considered as part of the evaluation, those criteria were set by industry. So it's that that's how influential industry has been. And what's been happening as well is these coformulants, by the way, they're not even on the package. Where if you buy a bottle of Roundup, in the vast majority of cases, they're just labeled as so-called inert. Inert because they're claiming that they don't act as a herbicide, therefore they're not considered as part of the evaluation. So, and they, an industry hides behind confidentiality clauses and doesn't disclose, you know, and their regulators don't oblige them to disclose what these coformulants, highly toxic coformulants are. At the end of the day, if you want to know what's there, you have to do your own chemical by chemical analysis to find out what is the nature of the coformulant. And my group has done that on a number of occasions to find out what these coformulants are. That was the only way we could find out. And I think the regulator is, when they assess the safety, the risk, when they conduct a risk assessment of glyphosate-based herbicides, they heavily rely on industry data, the dossiers of industry commissioned or conducted studies, and they pay little or no attention to the studies conducted by independent academic researchers such as myself, which clearly have no conflicts of interest, even though the studies we conduct are regulatory compliant. That's the way we've designed our rat toxicity studies. They are regulatory compliant. And yet, why are they being ignored by regulatory agencies? I've never got an answer to this question from any regulatory agency in Europe, such as the European Chemicals Agency or the European Food Standards, the European Food Safety Authority. But I think it's because they don't want to make life too difficult for industry. If they were to take into account the toxicity of the whole formulation, and not just glyphosate alone, then the permitted level of glyphosate exposure would have to be drastically reduced, massively reduced. It has to be anyway, and I'll come back to why that is the case now. Massively reduced, because it's clearly the formulation is far more toxic than the glyphosate alone. And I think it would have to be reduced to such a degree that the use of glyphosate herbicides would become incredibly restricted. You would have to, first of all, ban it from all domestic and urban use, which a number of European Union countries, by the way, have already done so, like in France. Very sensible, if you ask me. But then you'd also have to restrict its use in an agricultural context. And because so many massive amounts of GM crop cultivation are dependent on glyphosate herbicides, either alone or in combination now with other herbicides, which are even more toxic, such as dicamba and 2,4-D, that you would severely compromise these glyphosate-tolerant GM crop cultivations. And you would also have to ban its use in what is known as a pre-harvest desiccant. And here for me is the most ridiculous and unbelievable use of glyphosate herbicide that has become popular in the last 20 years or so. Some industry somehow has convinced farmers to spray with glyphosate herbicides within a few days of when they wish to harvest their crop. And here particularly I'm talking about cereal crops such as oats and wheat, barley, rye, and even some legumes and even potatoes. The idea, when it comes to the cereal crops, the way that the idea is sold by glyphosate herbicide manufacturers to farmers, spray your crop, it will intentionally kill it and will result in more uniform dryness of your grain, and you'll be able to harvest sooner. Very convenient. But what does that mean? It means that because you're harvesting so soon after you've sprayed your crop, your oats or your wheat, that there hasn't been any time for the glyphosate herbicide to dissipate. So what happens is high residue levels in wheat and oats are going straight into the human's food supply. And surveys of food products, of wheat and oat products, have shown in the United States particularly, have shown indeed high levels of glyphosate residues in these products. And they're not GMO, they're not genetically modified crops, so they're not coming from being sprayed as part of the natural cultivation cycle. The only way the glyphosate, and if the glyphosate is there, so are the coformulants, of course, you know, to go hand in hand. The only reason why the glyphosate herbicide is present in wheat and oat product is because it was pre-harvest desiccated. It is incredible. Just for convenience of being able to harvest, the farmer, unfortunately, is putting a highly toxic substance into foods that go straight into the human food chain. And you'd have to ban this as well. Again, in Europe, this was, they finally, you know, got the message. And in the European Union, pre-harvest desiccation of cereal crops has been banned. Glyphosate herbicides are not banned. In fact, glyphosate in 2023 was granted another 10-year market approval. But it was with some restrictions, including no use as a pre-harvest desiccant. So I think because of basically glyphosate herbicides, unfortunately, they're embedded in an economic and political framework. They're inseparable. They're embedded within this political and economic framework. And that has basically muddied the waters when it comes to the health risk assessment of this class of chemical, which has resulted in, for me, totally inadequate regulatory framework for this class of pesticide.
For those who are interested in more of the background of how industry has interfered in and even poisoned the science on this subject, I would direct them to my previous reporting, for example, my Project Censored award-winning reporting on that Seralini story, which you talked about earlier, and the way that that work was undermined and sabotaged and dragged through the mud incorrectly. I would also direct people to my previous work on Monsanto and its various schemes for ghostwriting articles and or muddying the public discourse around these issues, well documented, that has come out in some of these legal actions. But when it comes to the regulatory issue in particular, you've obviously been involved in the subject for a long time. You've been following this and seeing it from the inside out. When you look at the regulatory landscape, for example, in the US and in the UK and in the EU, do you see fundamental differences, or do you see these various locales essentially harmonizing their regulation or deregulation of this?
Yes. Good point. I see a degree of harmonization. It's not completely uniform, but I do see a degree of harmonization. And I think the reason for that is that all regulatory agencies around the world rely, as I mentioned earlier, almost not exclusive, or not completely, but very, very heavily on the same industry data that's presented to regulators for the risk assessment. In other words, the studies that industry has commissioned or carried out itself as part to meet regulatory risk assessment criteria and then the regulator assesses. And because they're all using that same industry data, they're coming to the same conclusions about safety and setting safety limits. We now know that much of this industry data is wanting. You mentioned earlier this year, a publication published in 2000, Williams and colleagues, 2000, which was a review article of the industry data on safety assessment of glyphosate, just glyphosate, not the formulations. And regulatory agencies around the world ever since then have repeatedly cited this industry this study by Williams and colleagues, this publication by Williams and colleagues, even though there was no original, it wasn't original new data, just a review of industry studies. That Williams publication concluded that there was no safety issues. It's not carcinogenic and it's not toxic in other ways, and therefore it's perfectly safe. And regulatory agencies have heavily relied on that. In 2023, I believe, when Europe risk assessed glyphosate, in the documentation produced by the European Food Safety Authority, they cited over 40 times the Williams paper to arrive at their conclusion that there's nothing wrong with glyphosate herbicides. But now, earlier this year, that Williams paper, the journal where that Williams paper was published, has been retracted because there were undisclosed conflicts of interest of the authors. But more importantly, they had solid evidence that actually this paper wasn't even written by the authors. It was ghostwritten by Monsanto. And these three academic scientists were called on just to add their name to the publication to give it some degree of credibility, to give it credibility. That is not science. That is really an act of deception. And so we are in a situation now where really, for me, regulators need to completely reassess their position. They've relied so heavily on industry data, which has now been questioned as to its validity. And certainly is, even if conducted well, there is other study, you know, and the industry studies show, oh yeah, it's not DNA damaging and it's safe. But there are other studies conducted by independent academics like myself, which show that actually glyphosate herbicides are toxic to through multiple mechanisms to multiple organs and systems in the physiology, and at doses that regulators say is absolutely safe. So, and I think, again, my group was the first to show that even a minuscule environmental dose of Roundup herbicide, this is a study that I conducted as a follow-up with Gilles-Éric Seralini, we showed that an incredible, what I called an ultra-low dose of glyphosate herbicide, commercial formulation, at a glyphosate concentration that is 125,000 times below the European Union safety limit and 250,000 times below the United States safety limit, after 2 years exposure, still resulted in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So we identified exposure to glyphosate herbicides as a risk factor for developing this very serious liver disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is really a global pandemic, because it doesn't matter where you are in the world, somewhere between 25 and 30% of the population suffer from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, there are other major risk factors. What we're saying here is that exposure to Roundup herbicides is previously unidentified risk factor for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So even minuscule doses of glyphosate herbicides given enough time, can result in serious disease. And this again, my group has shown how glyphosate and glyphosate herbicides result in numerous types of liver damage, including DNA damage, which is the major risk factor for cancer is damage to DNA, because it messes up our gene function and leads to cancer. And we have shown that through oxidative stress mechanism, I mentioned that earlier, through this reactive oxygen, oxidative stress mechanism, DNA damage can take place, and that predisposes to cancer. And human epidemiological studies have shown how glyphosate applicators, glyphosate herbicide applicators, farm workers, especially like immediately following the day when they were spraying, if you looked at markers of oxidative stress in their urine, they went right up. And one of those markers was also a DNA damaging marker. And I mention this because, in other words, what we see in the animals, there is some evidence that this is also happening in humans. Oxidative stress and DNA damage following application of glyphosate herbicides. I would like to go on, because the issue of cancer and glyphosate has been the hottest thing. You mentioned the International Agency for Research on Cancer, James, where in 2015 they published a monograph that included glyphosate assessment, and they concluded, based on definitive animal experiments and definitive cancer-causing mechanisms like oxidative stress, and not conclusive, but some human population survey data, that glyphosate herbicide exposure, not glyphosate alone, but just glyphosate herbicides generally, exposure to these was a probable human carcinogen, a class 2A, probable human carcinogen. And that, of course, just caused a huge eruption of opposition to IARC. But their work is unimpeachable in my view, even though, again, the usual suspects, industry and its allies, just attacked IARC, that they didn't do a good job and so on and so forth. But actually, when you looked at the data, there is definitive work that glyphosate causes DNA damage. And there's definitive work in animal model systems that glyphosate causes cancer, including industry studies from the 1980s. I believe in the court cases, the litigation cases, people bringing Bayer Monsanto to court, where they developed non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and they say this was due to their use of glyphosate herbicides over many years. During those court cases, it was revealed that Monsanto had data where glyphosate herbicides caused cancer, even in the 1980s, but they did not go public with it. But even so, having said that, for me, a landmark paper was published last year in June, a study led by the Ramazzini Institute in Italy. And my group was involved with that, with this. It was an international consortium of groups that included my own group. And in this study, again, it was completely regulatory compliant. The rats were exposed to either glyphosate alone at three doses and two different Roundup formulations, one typical of Europe, one typical of the United States, again, at the same glyphosate equivalent concentrations. And the glyphosate concentration, the highest, what's known as the regulatory recognized no observed adverse effect level. In other words, from animal studies, what European agency says, this is a dose of glyphosate at which no adverse outcome is seen in the animals. And the lowest dose in this in the study was what is known as the acceptable daily intake, which is 100 times lower than the no observed adverse effect level. And that's what regulators do. They to set safety limits, they take an animal study which has established a no observed adverse effect level dose of a chemical, and then they reduce that by 100-fold as a safety measure, which is sensible, of course. And that normally is a 100-fold reduction. So these animals had the range of doses, which regulators really said no adverse outcomes should have been seen in these rats. And the rats were exposed from mid-pregnancy. So again, to reflect a real-world scenario, let's face it, we're exposed from the womb onwards, not just when we're young adults. So the animals were exposed from mid-pregnancy and then continued through to 2 years of late adult life. And what shockingly was found was that even at the lowest dose of glyphosate alone, in other words, the acceptable daily, the European Union acceptable daily intake of glyphosate, which is 0.5 milligram per kilogram body weight per day, and which is half the acceptable daily intake in the United States and probably and many other regions around the world, probably Japan too. Even at this acceptable daily intake dose, rats got cancer, especially leukemias. They were most acute occurrence of leukemias with almost half the animals that got leukemia dying before the first year of life. Now, what does, and some cancers, so some cancers, such as leukemia and skin cancers, they were the same whether it was glyphosate alone or the Roundup formulations, showing that actually the cause of the cancer, of these types of cancers, was just the glyphosate. Now, that is really worrying. But some other cancers were only seen with the formulations, only with the commercial formulations, showing that it was the co-formulants that were driving, the toxic, the highly toxic adjuvant co-formulants that were driving the cancers in those instances. So what is, and bearing in mind, I'd like to emphasize again, this is a completely regulatory compliant study conducted by the Ramazzini Institute, completely in accord with Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD guidelines for this kind of cancer study. And what this study tells us is that clearly the current, that first of all, glyphosate and glyphosate herbicides are definitely carcinogenic, you know, absolutely. Yes, it takes time for them to have their effects. And that is not, and that's why you can be lulled into a false sense of security from glyphosate herbicide exposure, in that the effects can take time to manifest and you have trouble linking the two, the disease and the exposure. But in these animal studies, of course, everything is controlled. So we can make the definitive causative link. So that's the first thing. And also, clearly, the current acceptable daily intake, not only in Europe, but just everywhere in the world, because in other places in the world it's even higher, is clearly inaccurate or wrong. And that there needs to be an urgent, seriously urgent reassessment of glyphosate herbicide safety, risk assessment, and minimally the exposure level, the so-called safety, acceptable daily intake level, needs to be drastically reduced. And for me, since the acceptable daily intake is based on establishing a no observed adverse effect level, and at the moment, we don't know what that is for glyphosate herbicides. Therefore, we cannot set an acceptable daily safe intake limit. But for me, if I was to make an educated guess right now, I would say it would probably be in the order of about 1,000 times lower than where we are at the moment. So this is the situation that we have in a regulatory context. We know that we know that the European Food Safety Authority is considering the Ramazzini Institute carcinogenicity study data. They're reviewing it. I don't know what's happening in the United States or other territories around the world, whether they are taking on board the implications of the carcinogenicity study and reassessing the risk assessment of glyphosate. But for me, what we're looking at here is probably glyphosate was always touted by industry as the safest ever pesticide of any sort ever invented. That was the way it has been touted and sold over the decades around the world. But now, for me, it's turning out to be probably one of these deceptively toxic pesticides. It's a bit of deja vu in a way, because when the organochlorine insecticides were invented in the 50s, they were seen as completely inert, and people would even be spraying themselves with these insect killers, you know. But now, of course, they had massive environmental damage, as well as human health damage, such as breast cancer in women, increase in risk of breast cancer in women. And I think what we're seeing here is an almost deja vu experience of that, where because of the fact that the impact of glyphosate herbicides, typical exposures can take time to manifest as ill health, they lull you into a false, for me, into a false sense of security. But the scientific evidence has come on enormous, it's just grown and grown. There are well over 6,000 studies have been published on glyphosate to date. Most of those are on the health and environmental impacts of this class of chemical, and many of them are showing, obviously, damaging effects to environment and to health.
For the layman, that might be actually part of the problem, the overwhelming amount of studies that have been done on this subject. For somebody who has listened to this conversation and is interested and concerned, but would like to know more information, do you have any recommendations for either good websites or just good sources of information in general that can summarize and tell people about this information?
I do, actually. You mentioned GM Watch earlier at the beginning, James. GM Watch is an information website. They put out information on GM crops, genetically modified crop developments, and their associated pesticides. So anything significant that's come along regarding glyphosate herbicide toxicology, they write very good late summaries of these. I act in a scientific advisory capacity to GM Watch, so I'm always checking for these. They rely on me for the scientific accuracy, so you will find lots of very useful information on that as well. There are other sites, of course, that people can go to, but I think GM Watch is the most comprehensive.
I have been following GM Watch for years, so thank you for that effort that you've been making with them. It genuinely is a very valuable website for me and the work that I'm doing, so I hope people will follow their work. How about activist groups or anything that you know of that people might be, once they have become informed on this issue, might be able to get involved with? Is there anything that you might recommend that people might check out?
I think there are environmental NGOs, non-government organizations in many countries around the world that are fighting on this issue. Especially in Europe. I don't know the spectrum of listeners. I don't know groups in Japan, but in Europe, we have obviously Greenpeace Europe, Friends of the Earth Europe, Corporate Europe Observatory, and it's an organization called Viva Campesina. So there are numerous organizations. These tend to be multinational, but they're even on a national level. Really, I think it's a question of seeking them out, depending on which nation you're in. I would recommend really just you seek them out. But they will, in all likelihood, exist because of the people recognize just how bad pesticides can be. And as I say, if the safest pesticide, so-called safest pesticide like glyphosate, is this bad, deceptively toxic, what about all the rest? Paints a very dark picture for pesticides in general, which is why we need to move away from these chemicals, James. I mean, there are alternatives. There are very efficient agricultural practices, farming practices that have proven themselves around the world. And all it takes is the political will to support these initiatives, to really move towards a sustainable, robust, and safe agricultural system.
Well, then finally today, while we are holding our breath and waiting for the regulators to be uncaptured by the industries that have so clearly captured them, what do you do in your own personal life to reduce your glyphosate exposure, and what can other people be doing?
Yes, I'm asked this question frequently, and my answer is very simple. We buy as much organic food as we can afford, which basically we are 100% organic in my household. Here we buy from local organic farms whenever we can. So that is the main thing. Not only will you be reducing likelihood of exposure to glyphosate herbicides, but all pesticides. Surveys again have indicated that if you find any contaminating pesticide residue in organic food, because obviously organic farms tend to be embedded within a non-organic system, so there can be some cross-contamination, but the residue levels are tiny compared to what there is in conventional chemical-based agricultural food production. And so, yes, buy organic food. Don't use pesticides in your garden. That's another thing. If you want to remove weeds, pull them by hand or, you know, something like that, which is what we do. And filter your water as well. We have a filtration unit in our household where which gets rid of all organics, contaminants that may be there. So these are fairly simple measures one can take that can really massively reduce your pesticide exposure for yourself and your loved ones, and avoid the long-term, especially the long-term health risks that are just recognized now. You know, the evidence is very, very clear that pesticide exposure is simply not good for you, even at the safe regulatory limits. And again, I should have mentioned this earlier. When a regulator sets exposure limits for a given pesticide, it does it one pesticide active ingredient at a time. But you and I, we're all exposed to cocktails of pesticides on a daily basis. Tens of different pesticides we can be exposed to on a daily basis through our food supply. Does the regulator take that into account? Not at all. There's a lot of talk going on about how they should be considering mixture effects, but I'm afraid up to now, it's just been talk. And again, work in my lab as well as elsewhere, we have tested mixtures of pesticides. And again, even at levels that regulators say acceptable daily intake mixtures of pesticides, we see negative outcomes on the gut microbiome, on liver function, gut integrity. One of the most dramatic effects we saw in a study recently we published was we tested a mixture of glyphosate, 2,4-D and dicamba, three herbicides that are massively, increasingly used in the United States. Because weeds have become resistant to glyphosate, farmers are now mixing 2,4-D and dicamba on their GM crops. GM crops are engineered for multiple herbicides. This mixture at the acceptable daily intake of glyphosate, 2,4-D and dicamba was massively damaging to the gut structure and function in our rat study. I mean, it was shockingly bad. So this is another reason why our regulators, I'm sorry to say to your listeners, regulators are letting us down. They're not protecting us properly from the mixtures of the pesticides, not just glyphosate alone, but for the mixtures of pesticides, insecticides, fungicides, along with other herbicides. We're just not, the regulatory system is just not protecting us with their current approach that they are taking to evaluating the health risks. So that's my recommendation. Grow your own food. If you've got a bit of garden, grow some of your own. It's great fun. That's what we do. But buy organic. I know many people say organic can be more expensive, and it can be. But if you buy and cook from scratch, you know, it's processed foods that are really expensive. You can actually eat organically quite affordably. And if your budget is limited, then certain things to avoid are focus your budget. What budget you have for organic, make sure cereal products are organic. The oats, the wheat, you know, your bread, your flour, these things should be organic. And also green leafy vegetables and soft fruits. the highest pesticide residues are invariably found on green leafy vegetables and soft fruits. So use your organic budget at least for these. And you'll be, again, making a significant reduction in your exposure levels.
Well, some sage advice. As I say, as we hold our breath and wait for the political will to muster in order to actually change this regulatory environment, at any rate, there are things people can be doing to reduce their exposure, if not eliminate it altogether. So I hope people will check into that. Dr. Michael Antonio, we could talk about this for a very long time, and we already have been, but I think we'll leave this conversation here today, but hopefully encouraging and exhorting listeners to check out resources like GM Watch if they want to know more about this information. And I think we'll leave this conversation here. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, James, for the invitation, and all the best to you and your listeners.